Is the president backing away from a public option for health care? Well, here's the presidential answer.
The public option, whether we have it or we don't have it, is not the entirety of health care reform. This is just one sliver of it, one aspect of it. And by the way, it's both the right and the left that have become so fixated on this that they forget everything else.
Health care and everything else we're fixated on this morning on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 17th. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Amy Holmes.
Good morning. I know I'm fixated.
Yeah, I know.
Healthcare and everything else. Coming up this hour, the president is heading to the Vineyard with his family. Then it's back to school shopping on the cheap. Is retail back to normal? And John Stewart has competition in, of all places, Catherine, Afghanistan.
Yeah, but first we're here with Dr. Michael Pramenko. He's a family physician in Grand Junction, Colorado, you might recall. That's where the president was speaking this weekend at a healthcare town meeting. Okay, Michael, you were there. Nearly everyone in the country would love the chance to ask the president about his plans for healthcare reform. This is your big moment, doctor, your spotlight in the healthcare debate. Come on, what happened?
Well, it was exciting for Grand Junction, and I did get to meet him backstage.
No, you didn't get to have that one-on-one you were thinking of?
No, we didn't get to have the one-on-one conversation, huh?
Now, what do you guys in Grand Junction know about healthcare reform that the rest of us should know?
Well, for 30 years, we've been practicing cost-effective medicine in a nonprofit, privately run system, and it's working really well.
Okay, that sounds intriguing. We're going to find out more. Stay with us, doctor. But first, everything else you need to know in the news this morning.
The Obama administration says there should be competition in the health insurance market, even as it's backing off its public plan. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius told CNN the White House is open to letting nonprofit co-ops sell insurance as an alternative. While GOP lawmakers are circling health care, the president's talking to the nation's largest group of combat veterans today in Phoenix. He'll talk about the nation's responsibility to maintain a world-class military. In the Atlantic, the first hurricane of the Atlantic season, Hurricane Bill, is gaining strength. Meanwhile, in Florida, Claudette has been downgraded, fortunately, to a tropical depression. It's dumping heavy rains over the region, but flooding isn't expected.
South of the border, Mexico is scrapping its entire force of customs inspectors, replacing them with 1,400 agents trained to fight drug smuggling. The government has sent soldiers to airports and border crossings to take back the guns issued to inspectors. Another major economy coming out of recession, Japan says its economy grew at a pace of 3.7% last quarter. Japan joins Germany, France, and Hong Kong in the recovery. And a little later, we're going to get a look at how the U.S. economy is doing today with fresh numbers on the housing market. Continuing our economic news, that good news from Japan would make you think, but the Asian markets are actually down today. The Dow is going to open next hour at 9321. The S&P begins at 10:04. And the NASDAQ starts trading down about 1% at 1985. Meanwhile, the president and his opponents are out there campaigning, and it's your turn to weigh in on the healthcare debate. What's convincing you, confusing you, upsetting you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Amy Holmes. We're in for John Hockenberry this morning. Hey, Amy, the Obama administration seems to be backing away from a public option for health care reform. Listen to Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. She's speaking to CNN's John King about what we're likely to see coming from the Senate Finance Committee.
They've been more focused on a not-for-profit co-op as a competitor as opposed to a straight government-run program. And I think what's important is choice and competition. And I'm convinced at the end of the day the plan will have both of those. But that is not the essential element.
Okay, you're from Washington. What is she saying there?
Not the essential element. Interesting tag phrase there. Is it backpedaling? Is it a trial balloon? I guess we'll see who gets mad.
Well, let's go to Julie Mason. She's a White House reporter for the Washington Examiner. She's also a good friend of the show. All right, Julie, you heard that sound. What change does this say to you about healthcare reform?
Well, what it says to me is they don't have the votes, especially in the Senate. They got to drop the public option. And we've been hearing this about 2 weeks. The administration's been floating this, well, maybe we can do without the public option trial balloon. It really came to a head over this past weekend.
Julie, that's interesting that you would say they don't have the votes. Is this actually a way of them trading votes to be able to get some Republican votes on board?
Yes, Republicans, Amy, and also moderate Democrats. The moderate Democrats are the ones who have been pushing to drop this provision, so it really mollifies them if the administration will back off from it. Of course, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is furious about this. Howard Dean, especially, is very angry. He wants to see the public option.
I thought at one point the president was saying that he could do this without Republican votes. So what kind of turnaround is it that suddenly now he's decided he needs both moderates and the Republicans?
Well, it's just a bit of Washington pragmatism, especially because he hasn't been able to keep his own party together on this bill. He hasn't, they've been so fractured, and so he needs some moderate Republicans to come on board, but especially his own party, who have not backed him the way that he had hoped or the way that he needs in order to get this passed.
And let's fold in Dr. Michael Pramenko. He is a family physician in Grand Junction, Colorado, where, of course, President Obama had his town meeting this weekend. Dr. Pramenko, what changed? I mean, do you see this as a tactic of sending up a trial balloon, or do you think the fact that he was speaking in Grand Junction is signaling, yeah, this is the way we're going to go?
Yeah, I mean, the timing on this, you go back a couple of weeks when we started hearing rumblings that he was coming here, and you had to figure, okay, why is he coming to a county in western Colorado that voted 2-1 for the other guy and has a system that's set up privately with a nonprofit system? Why is he coming to such a place? And after what happened the last 24 hours, where we heard this quote, and then we heard the surrogates on television stating similar things, I think this was strategic, and I definitely think that they saw the writing on the wall and made some decisions here.
You've touched on this earlier, but tell me again, what is it that you guys do that the rest of us aren't doing in Grand Junction?
We have various organizations, most of them nonprofit, that for years have been working collaboratively with a lot of cooperation to attain a system that's very high quality at low cost. And this was highlighted on June 1st in New Yorker, and now more recently, 3 days ago, by the New America Foundation, which released a paper specifically on Grand Junction.
So, Julie, pardon me. Keep going, Michael.
No, thank you. Thank you. It's essentially a nonprofit-run system that's obtaining many of the goals that people want to see at a national level.
So, Julie Mason, as a White House reporter, was this trip planned, or how did this get on the president's agenda? Why now?
Well, you know, they've been doing a bunch of these town hall events, and usually they're very, you know, it's Obama supporters lobbing softballs like, how can we help you pass health care reform? And they put a lot of people in the audience who are very sympathetic or who are even Obama volunteers. They went to Grand Junction and also to New Hampshire and Montana in order not to provoke a confrontation, but to sort of mix it up a little bit and to show the president sort of nimbly defending his program from people who didn't like it and don't like him. And they think that that showcases him very well. It also brings up the temperature a little bit. All the passion in this issue is on the other side.
Well, in
and
fact,
they wanted to show the president having a little passion on this issue.
And let's take a listen to him.
What you can't do is start saying things like, we want to set up death panels to pull the plug on grandma. I mean, come on. I just lost my grandmother last year. I know what it's like to watch somebody you love who's aging deteriorate and have to struggle with that.
Wow. Now, is that a switch in tactics?
Completely for the president. Yes, he's been, up until now, he's been giving sort of cool professorial answers, trying to be sort of soothing and instructive about health care reform. And meanwhile, the other side has been very passionate, very vocal, emotional. We've seen people sobbing in town halls. So here comes the president. He's talking about his grandmother. He's getting very personal. It doesn't come naturally to him to be like that. He really has to dig down deep to get this sort of high dudgeon going. It's not reflexive. He's not a reflexive politician in that way. So this is a new message for him, and it really brings up the passion, and I think it really gets people's attention.
Dr. Pramenko, did you see that kind of passion from the president in Grand Junction?
Yeah, it was really quite a thrill to see him speak and have a mastery of this of this topic. I've been involved with health policy now for four or five years, and he does a better job with this than many of the policy wonks as far as explaining and describing what needs to happen, not only from a personal level, but from an economic, financial level.
And well, let's hear what happens when someone decides to tangle with the president. This is Zach Lane. He's a student at the University of Colorado in Boulder, asking a question.
How in the world can a private corporation providing insurance compete with an entity that does not have to worry about making a profit, does not have to pay local property taxes? They do not have to, they're not subject to local regulations. How can a company compete with that?
All right, Michael, how can a company compete with that?
Well, I certainly think that there's still an open debate on that. And, you know, we can't debate about euthanasia and death panels. Those things are ridiculous arguments. But there can be an honest debate, and the president said that, about whether or not that's going to happen. I believe that we can get an option that is nonprofit and doesn't have to pay some of those taxes and compete with these for-profit companies. And this is a really important point. If I can take a moment to speak to folks out there that are really, really angry and disappointed about this possibility coming down the pike, if that's okay. If the current legislation continues to offer guarantees that pre-existing conditions can be used, that can't be used to deny coverage, if it ends the practice of insurance caps and provides a good package that's, you know, that includes preventative health care and some of the robust elements that we need in a basic life, in a basic plan, what more above and beyond that can we get from a government plan that we can't get from nonprofits as an option or co-ops as an option? That's really important to think about. If the legislation does include those guarantees, we might be able to get 95% of what folks out there want. That's really an important question to ask ourselves.
And so it sounds like the takeaway question here is, you know, how much of healthcare reform can we get done?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Grand Junction is proof, absolute proof, that we can do this through nonprofits and we can do it in a quality fashion. Again, most people out there really are concerned that they're going to still be able to, you know, the insurance companies are still going to be able to walk all over them. If that is included in other elements of this legislation, then the importance of having a government-run option really gets whittled down to a very little sliver if it's included in other parts of the legislation, which, as of now, it appears like it is.
Okay. Dr. Pimenko, family physician in Grand Junction, Colorado, I want to thank you for joining us. Julie Mason, I want to round up things with you. What kind of horse trading are we going to see going on this week when it comes to the public option and trying to get those moderate Democrats and Republicans?
Well, we're not going to see that much. It's going on largely behind the scenes. I think what we're really going to see when Congress comes back in September, we're going to see a lot of horse trading. And what I fear is that this bill is going to become so deeply compromised that it's not really going to help anyone. So that's a big fear, and that's something the White House is very concerned about.
I was just going to say that's something that the Democrats are really concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, quick, the takeaway question for the week, what should we be looking at when it comes to health care?
How far the White House is willing to compromise what they said they wanted. I mean, here we see the public option. That was the one thing that was non-negotiable, and now it appears to be on the table.
Oh, come on, Julie. Nothing's non-negotiable in Washington. That's Julie Mason, White House reporter for the Washington Examiner.
So, Catherine, I want to get our listeners to weigh in on this.
Mm-hmm.
So what's convincing you, confusing you, upsetting you?
It really saddens me that so many people feel that profit margins and the bottom line and so-called competition are so much more important than the idea that every American should get health care.
Call us and put your voice into the mix at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes. I'm here with Catherine Lamfer. So, Catherine, for a lot of families, it is back to school. But the question is retail back to normal? Economists say that the recession is over, but parents are still feeling the pinch. Here to talk with us about that in the studio is Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times, and also Mary Elizabeth Williams, culture critic for Salon.com. Welcome, ladies.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So, Louise, what's going on? Economists say, you know, we're out of the woods, but parents are not in the shopping malls.
It's going to take a while till regular people see the impact of the recession ending. And so for now, they're clinging to their money. They're telling Junior they don't get many treats this year. And we can already see from July sales figures that they're not spending much on back-to-school supplies.
So how does this fall compare to recessions past?
Some analysts say this will be the first decline in back-to-school spending in more than a decade. And people are trimming back in everything from electronics to clothing for their kids.
And does this have an impact for retailers looking into the future in terms of, like, holiday shopping?
Absolutely. You know, you spend the most on your kids for their birthdays, for back to school, and for the holidays. And back to school is the second biggest time after the holidays. And presents are already being shipped over to the factories. So if retailers have misestimated for this holiday season, it'll be a big problem. And this is the leading indicator for holiday sales.
Hey, but we didn't have this problem at the beginning of the school year last year, and we already were hurting, but people were still buying the new backpacks and the pencil sets. So what's different now?
Well, that's because the last thing you cut back on is your child. You know, if you can cut back on something else, you do. And earlier in the recession, people didn't know how bad it would be. And remember, the stock market didn't decline as much until last fall, after people had already loaded up on back-to-school goodies. So it's really only this fall that we're seeing people feeling a lot poorer.
So, Mary Elizabeth, are you cutting back on your children?
I like that. This is the bad mother moment.
Kids, I'm sorry this year. No shoes for you. It's a little more like maybe you're not going to get the box of 64. Maybe we're only going to get the box of 16 this year. But the other thing that's happening for a lot of parents around the country, and I'm certainly feeling it, is the schools are facing budget cuts. Aside from the fact that so many parents now are unemployed or are taking pay cuts, schools themselves have been taking a pay cut. So when I looked at my children's list of supplies for the year, it wasn't just the usual notebooks and pens. It was also supplies just for the classrooms themselves. So we're actually being asked to spend more than ever before. It's not just about buying sneakers. It's our school needs a broom and dustpan. Our school needs a printer. Please help us add to a fund so that we can get things just for the classroom. So we're being demanded more. We're being asked more than ever before.
But this would seem to put parents in a real squeeze. I mean, if we see that unemployment is going up and so people are worried about their family incomes, they're paying taxes, now they're paying on top of that. How are folks handling it?
It's terrible. My school got a $300,000 cut last year. And so if they're asking for additional printer labels, we can certainly understand it. But it's very, very hard. And those of us who are lucky enough, knock on wood right now, to still be unemployed are really going to be asked to step up even more than ever. And where I have to cut back is definitely on my own expenses.
Sweatpants?
I'm wearing more sweatpants. The jeans are a little more frayed than ever. But it's also, you know, if it's not that, like, go out and outfit your kids in a whole new wardrobe for the fall.
Yeah, let me just say a word on behalf of the nation's adolescents. Mom, I have to have the right jeans.
Oh.
Come on. What are you doing to me?
Yeah, this year, kids, you're all going to be shame walking through the aisles together. That's the good part. There's not going to be a whole lot of fancy trapper keepers in the hallways this year.
But I think a question a lot of people would have, though, is this a result just of the recession, or is there bad management also going on?
In terms of
the school budget.
It's so on a state by state level. You know, we who live in New York can look to what's happened in Albany and say that was kind of an interesting. It's been interesting times for us. But it's also on the level of individual schools. Of course, private schools it's a completely different story. And what they're dealing with is declining enrollments because of the economy. So they're feeling the pinch even more as well.
I want to ask you about these status conscious teens and those labels that I remember were so important, the, you know, Perry topsiders and the Guess jeans. Are there some labels that are really suffering and other labels that actually are getting a boost?
Yes, so the cheaper brands are going to do better, you know, an Aeropostale. But, you know, if your child asks to go to J. Crew or something where it's pricier, you might say not this year.
And it also seems that apparel in general mm-hmm. is suffering because that's kind of the last thing that your kid needs. Your kid really needs the notebook
and
the pencils.
That seems like a luxury. And if you've got to take in stuff to the schools like mops, then you're going to cut back on clothes. But, of course, that's not what kids want to hear.
I see. Well, thank you, ladies, for joining us. And I hope your kids are going to get some goodies when they go back to school.
Yeah, really.
That was Mary Elizabeth Williams, culture critic for Salon.com, and Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times. And we got an email from you at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Jen emails us saying, quote, I'm a single mom and I was unemployed for over a year. My daughter is 13 years old. And this year I'm throwing last year's backpack in the wash. And her binder is also still in good shape. She doesn't need new clothes either. Although she likes new things, she's absolutely fine with her old things that still fit. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear from you. And now let's get an update on some of the stories we're watching this morning. Catherine?
In Florida, tropical storm Claudette has weakened to a tropical depression. That says Hurricane Bill has become the first hurricane in the Atlantic this year. Bill has winds near 75 miles per hour and is expected to strengthen over the next few days. Further overseas, Japan's economy grew by 3.7% last quarter. It joins Germany, France, and Hong Kong in an apparent recovery from the global financial crisis. That improvement was driven by high demands for electronic goods. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is in Washington today, meeting with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Tomorrow, he meets with President Obama, his first White House visit in 5 years.
In Thailand, the American who was released from Myanmar prison over the weekend is in a Bangkok hospital. His family says he's in poor health. Moving now to the World Track and Field Championships in Berlin, where Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt broke his own world record in the 100-meter dash. He ran it in 9.58 seconds. Up next for Bolt is the 200-meter race. He holds the world record for that, too. That's just some of what we're following today.
Now, coming up, we're going to find out what's making headlines, what will be making headlines in the week ahead. So open up those agendas of yours. That's just in a few minutes. Meanwhile, we're continuing to hear from you about healthcare.
I wish you would point out, in terms of the issue of competition, that in most states, there is no competition among private insurance companies. They hold virtual monopolies, as far as I understand.
Okay, we have been asking you all morning, and we still want to hear from you. What confuses you? What confounds you? What upsets you when it comes to health care reform and the talk you're hearing all around you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or write us, mytake@thetakeaway.org. So what's your takeaway health care phrase for the day?
I think it's not an essential element of the plan.
Oh,
with
mine
that public option.
Caucus containment.
Ooh, I like that.
Talking about trying to get the Democrats to accept possibly some alternatives to a public plan. Caucus containment. I like that.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
It's Monday morning, Amy. You know what that means.
It means the agenda.
It also means Marvin Gaye. I mean, I don't know about you. My morning's better already. She's right. It's time for the agenda. This is our quick look at the week ahead, both here at home and abroad. We're going to be talking to Chris Hayes, Washington editor for The Nation magazine, and also Rob Watson, diplomatic correspondent for our partners at the BBC. But first, we're going to start with Chris. All right, Chris, I know that you're actually on vacation in Cape Cod. What a good man to get up early and talk to us. We appreciate it.
We applaud you.
We do.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Now, when I imagine the president opening up his agenda for the week, it says in big letters, float trial balloon on backpedaling from public health care option. Something like that for this week?
Yeah, although I have to say, they've been sort of sowing the seeds of if I can mix metaphors mid-sentence.
We do that a lot on this show.
Yeah. They've been sowing the seeds of folding on this for a while. I mean, I think that there was a period, if you go back about 3 or 4 weeks ago, in which it looked like just in terms of the legislative compromises happening in Congress, the public option was sort of not in very good shape. And then there was a real concerted effort, particularly among progressive House members, to basically draw a line in the sand and say, look, we actually will not vote for a bill that doesn't have a strong public option. And that kind of pushed it back in. The White House has been supporting it, but as you note, they're already sort of announcing that everything seems to be quote-unquote negotiable.
Well, I seem to recall Rahm Emanuel saying very early on that this was negotiable, and President Obama saying, no, this is
exactly.
This has to be in there. So what are we hearing now from progressives?
Well, progressives are, I mean, the Progressive Caucus, which is the largest caucus in the United States House of Representatives, they have really attempted to kind of organize internally the caucus and have a strong declarative statement saying, you know, this is the make or break issue for a bill that we will or won't vote for. And of course, with, I forget, 60 plus 70 members, you know, if they're actually able to enforce caucus cohesion, they could kill something. I mean, that actually could be dispositive as to whether it gets passed out of the House or not. So the White House is, as we all have watched this go on, is playing a very difficult balancing game between trying to sort of on one side you have Mike Enzi from Wyoming, who's a Republican senator who's part of the so-called Gang of Six in the Senate, who's working out the health care compromise. I mean, he is very conservative, a very conservative voting record and representing a very conservative state. And somehow the White House at some point may be forced to choose whether they're going to have a bill that Mike Enzi votes for or they're going to have a bill that the base of their own party is happy with.
I think you've given me the takeaway phrase for this segment, which is caucus cohesion. Now, we mentioned that you're on vacation quickly. The president has a different agenda coming up very soon, a family vacation on Martha's Vineyard. What do you know about that trip?
So they're going to be renting. I was reading about how the very complicated legal arrangements for a vacation when you're the first family. So they're renting a farm in a sort of rural part of the island. It's actually been, I think, the Clintons visited there before, and they're going to be paying for it, right? It's a family vacation, but of course they bring an entire retinue of Secret Service and so forth, and that's going to be taxpayer dollars. So there's a very little complicated bit of legal jujitsu going on. And then there's a lot of excitement, and particularly in the Oak Bluffs area of Martha's Vineyard, which is sort of a legendary and historic African-American summer destination and getaway, that this is a sort of a coming home, if you will. And there's a lot of celebration around that.
Let's quickly move to some more serious news. Senator Jim Webb is the most senior U.S. official to visit Myanmar in over 20 years. And I think I'm not alone. For a lot of us, when we heard that he was over there to win the release of John Yatta, we went, Jim Webb, Myanmar? Huh? What's going on there?
Well,
what was at stake for Webb?
You know, Webb is kind of an idiosyncratic guy, and his politics, particularly in international politics, have always been idiosyncratic. He's always had a long interest in that region of the world. He's written books about that part of the world. And I think he, you know, obviously the Burmese regime is a brutal and repressive one, and we all kind of have this iconic image of Aung San Suu Kyi and her sort of struggle against the junta there. And Webb, I think, has, you know, is quite different from most of his colleagues, both in the Democratic Party and basically the sort of foreign policy establishment, in that he's one of the few people pushing more engagement with the Burmese government. This has been something he's actually advocated for quite some time.
All right. We need to keep moving on with our agenda. But Chris Hayes, I want to thank you. Chris Hayes, The Nation Magazine's Washington editor. We're going to turn now to Rob Watson. He is a diplomatic correspondent for our partners at the BBC. Rob, let's move quickly now to the elections coming up in Afghanistan on Thursday. We're hearing a lot about threats toward Afghans who will go to vote. What glimpse can you give us of what we're going to see between now and Election Day?
Well, certainly what the Western countries who have troops deployed in Afghanistan want to see is something that could be described as a credible and legitimate election. Now, notice not the word perfect, ideal, absolutely spot on Western model democracy, but something where at the end of the day you'll be able to say, thank goodness, the government that's emerged from this is legitimate.
So, Rob, what's the likelihood of that?
Well, I think it's going to be a real uphill struggle. Certainly, the Taliban seem to have changed their tactics from 5 years ago. 5 years ago, the Taliban were aware of the fact that many Afghans were really excited about the idea of voting in an election. It was a big deal for them, something new. because the government is so much less popular now, because there's quite a lot of disenchantment with the way politics work in Afghanistan, and because, of course, the Taliban is now actually saying, we will come and get you if you vote, I think there really are fears in some part of the country as to what turnout will be like.
Rob, we're also hearing a lot about women being the special target of threats. Not to mention, there was also a bill that President Karzai passed into law saying a man can withhold food from his wife if she refuses sex. So very quickly, what's at stake for women here in this election?
Well, you're absolutely right about this controversy over a bit of law that was designed specifically, I think, to appease the male sector of certain Shiite electorates. Well, you know, I guess what women in Afghanistan would say is that they're deeply worried at this moment in time. They're worried about a resurgence of the Taliban, and they're worried about talk from both the Afghan government and indeed from Western governments suggesting that at some point down the road, some of these people with very hardline views are going to have to be negotiated with, including the Taliban.
All right. Rob, I want to thank you for your time. That's Rob Watson, diplomatic correspondent for our partners at the BBC. And we will be continuing our conversation about the Afghan elections a little later this morning.
So, Catherine, you've heard of The Daily Show, right?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out Afghanistan has their own version called The Danger Bell. And we're going to be finding out how it might be impacting these upcoming elections. Political satire, warlords, sounds like a kind of dangerous
mix. I was going to say,
mix.
Do warlords have a sense of humor?
We'll find out in 10 minutes.
Okay.
You're listening to The Takeaway. Good morning. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. History was made in the 100-meter finals at the World Championships in Berlin, Germany yesterday.
They get away first time. Tyson Gay right alongside Usain Bolt, but here he goes. Streaking away already. It's Bolt all the way. He's looking round at Gay. Watch the clock. It's gold for Bolt. And again, he's done it again. A new world record for Usain Bolt.
Wow. This was billed as a big showdown between American Tyson Gay and Jamaican Usain Bolt, but it turned out to be a blowout. He left Gay in the dust. He shattered his own world record by 0.11 seconds, running it, as we heard, 9.58 seconds. Tyson Gay won the silver. And Bolt's fellow countryman, Asefa Powell, took bronze. Right now, we're going to go to our own gold medal commentator, the Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Okay, was a guy, did he ever have a better name for a runner? Bolt?
Usain Bolt. I think he's one of these guys that created the name for himself. But Usain Bolt, last year in the Olympics, shattered the world record then, and he shocked people, and he did it in nonchalant fashion. And then yesterday, we were just talking about it, he sort of gave a little bit more effort, and because of that extra effort, he blew his world record away.
Wow. And, you know, when he was done, did we have any of the moves that we had during the Olympics?
A lot of us like that.
It was definitely, Usain Bolt is a showman. He's an international superstar. He is the world's fastest man in the history of the history of speed. And him and his countryman, Asefa Powell, did the victory lap together. I think this race, and Tyson Gay, you can't take him out of it. These are the three fastest men. Tyson Gay made an American record yesterday as well. So it was an extremely fast race yesterday, the fastest race in history.
Wow. All right. Let's go to another big news event yesterday. Tiger Woods. He blew it. What happened?
Tiger Woods was not putting well on the greens. Tiger Woods had it was the first time he was 14 out of 14 in major championships when he was leading into the final rounds. Yesterday.
Oh, I was just going to say, let's hear him.
I didn't win today. Tom, I, as I said, I played well enough the entire week to win the championship, and especially today I hit the ball well enough. And you have to make putts, and I didn't do that.
So, Ibrahim, what is it like to be the guy who wins only because Tiger Woods was having an off day?
I don't know. You know, that's interesting. There's a couple things that happen here. Tiger Woods is the number one ranked player in the world. Y.E. Yang is the number 110th ranked player in the world.
Wow.
Tiger Woods has 70 wins. Yang had one win previous. But what happens in golf is that the conditions and the particular moment in history come together. Yang is from a part of Korea which is windy and it's a very warm part. Yesterday, the conditions favored Yang, particularly in some of the longer, into the 16th and 17th and 18th holes, which were some of the most difficult holes in championship golf this year. No one was shooting well at all yesterday in those holes. The moment came in the 14th. Tiger was in the sand pit, but Yang was a little bit on the edge of the green on the rough, and he made an incredible putt that went in, and I think that was the moment. It was on the 14th or 15th hole, and it was just a really incredible moment. So I think it was really Yang. Look, it was like doing a staring contest with a guy with no eyelids, and he stared him down.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I just have this image of Yang holding his golf bag over his head.
History was made for the Asian golfers and international golf in general.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaways sports contributor.
Good morning.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes here with Catherine Lamford. So, Catherine, Afghanis have their very own version of The Daily Show. They make fun of warlords.
Hey, wait, do warlords have a sense
of humor?
That would
seem pretty risky. We'll be hearing more about that. But we've also been hearing from you on the healthcare debate. Let's take a listen.
No public option, no robust, serious, heavy-duty public option is a complete betrayal of the whole premise of healthcare reform. It allows the insurance industry to win the battle. It allows nobody who's a consumer to get any real savings.
Strong, strong emotions out there. So with the president and his opponents out there campaigning, it's your turn. We want to hear from you. So please give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org and tell us your views. But first, the top stories.
Okay. President Obama in Arizona today, where he's speaking to veterans. He's expected to update them on the status of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and to talk about his defense budget. Tropical storm Claudette made news as the first named storm to hit the U.S. mainland this year, but now it's been downgraded to a depression. Claudette is moving across Florida to Alabama. Meanwhile, Hurricane Bill is forming out there on the Atlantic, expecting to strengthen in the coming days. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan. He's talking there about advances against the Taliban.
We all know the underlying problems are still to be dealt with, but we're much better off today, and we appear to be one less very bad person around by Tula Masood.
Batula Masood was the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, thought to have been killed in a U.S. airstrike. Holbrooke also says the U.S. will send more weapons to aid Pakistan's fight. Okay, here is a breaking story that you especially, I think, are going to like, Amy. This is both from Politico.com and ABC's Jake Tapper. Former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is joining the cast of ABC's Dancing with the Stars. That's not a joke. This is not a test. He's known all summer, and he's been working out with a trainer. He starts rehearsals with his dance partner in the next week.
I guess you could say he was swift-footed. I don't know.
Something like that.
Another story that we're talking about is Afghanistan. The elections are on Thursday, and as you might expect, it's dominating the Afghan news. But you know what else they have on TV? They have political comedy. And with us to discuss it is Jahid Mohseini, producer of Danger Bell, Afghanistan's own version of The Daily Show. Jahid is the director of Tolo TV, a popular private TV channel that regularly skewers the Afghan political elite. Thanks for joining us, Jahid.
Thank you for having me.
Terrific. So I understand your show, Danger Bell, is being compared to The Daily Show. What do you think of that comparison?
Well, it's probably a little bit unfair to The Daily Show, to be honest. It's more a satirical comedy, and we're sort of humor is ingrained into our culture, but on media and on television, it's still a developing art form. So the program, what it does do is it provides a mirror against for the politicians in particular, and says some of the unmentionables that are going on every day, but no one dares to say. So it's being watched.
We all know that comedy comes from whatever is taboo. So I'm curious, what kind of sense of humor do warlords have? Because obviously one of the things you do is poke fun at them.
Well, we pretty much poke fun at everyone at some stage or another. Well, I don't. They do. I just get the bad phone calls the next day. But they sort of push through. And fundamentally, for a private organization, we gauge everything based on our viewers. And they have their own measure of what is acceptable and not. So we raise issues and you know, through a comedy format, we're actually tackling serious issues, but it puts the right kinds of pressure and it allows you to say things you can't say in news through satire and through comedy programming.
So, Jahid, the question Catherine and I have had all morning is, how do you get away with this? It would seem like to be a pretty dangerous programming decision to make fun of folks who, you know, might fight back.
Well, you know, we've kind of had to deal with this since 2003 when we launched our radio station and then eventually into the TV station in 2004. It's surprising. I mean, for us, everything we do is based on viewers. If you have the public behind you and if you maintain the standards, as it were, and not push beyond the line of bad taste, you'd be surprised at what you can get away with even in a place like Afghanistan.
So where is that line?
Sense of humor is fairly ingrained.
Sure. So where is that line? What are some of your best jokes?
Well, it's not so much jokes, but we show different things. I mean, they do songs about ministers being potentially corrupt or being too focused on taking holidays and taking money rather than delivering results. They make fun of key people in administration who, like mayors, etc., that are ineffective. So they push through on most of those things. And again, it's on Wednesday nights, and Thursday mornings is a headache morning because you get the calls from the people who watched it the night before.
What can you say that the nation's news media can't say?
Well, our news is obviously has to be, by news standards and has to be very careful about what it says. It needs to be, it can't make its own statements. It needs to be statements by others, etc. Whereas the comedy guys have a fair bit more leeway. They're not held to journalistic standards, as it were, where they require a quote from someone in order to make a statement. They can make a statement knowing the facts that all Afghans know. Whereas the news may not necessarily be able to get a quote from someone that says that, these guys can have the leeway to actually go out and say it. And that's one of the reasons that it's popular. It actually says what people think.
Interesting, which is, of course, the purpose of political comedy. You're listening to Jahid Mohseini, director of Tolo TV, a popular private TV channel in Afghanistan, with a show that's being compared to The Daily Show. I'd like to also bring in Martin Patience of the BBC to give us a status report on the upcoming elections. He joins us from Mazar Sharif in northern Afghanistan. Martin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So have you seen Jahid's show?
No, I haven't. I have to admit, it's in Dari, and I have to admit, I don't understand Dari.
I
know Jahid well. No, I'm not, sadly.
So getting to the elections on Thursday, we've been talking about it all morning. Secretary Robert Gates had this to say this weekend.
It looks like more Afghans will be able to vote than had been the case before the recent deployment of additional U.S. forces.
So what do you make of that statement? Are you seeing that on the ground?
Well, certainly military commanders. What Robert Gates is referring to is the major operation in Helmand Province. Now, Helmand Province is in the south of the country, and we've seen British forces and American forces conduct two separate operations. And what they say they've done, is moved into Taliban strongholds, cleared those strongholds of the militants, and they now say that the Afghans in those locations will be able to go to the polling stations. But one of my colleagues was down there just a few days ago in Babaji, that was in relation to the British operation, and the locals he spoke to there said that they weren't going to turn out to vote. And the reason they weren't going to turn out to vote, they said, is that the government wasn't doing anything for them.
Well, you know, that actually brings me to a quote that really struck me, that sort of seems to contradict a bit what Secretary Gates was saying. It's from our American ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, and he said that he, quote, "I have no advice to give to the Afghan common citizen, common man, in regards to the violence." How worried are Afghani officials?
about upcoming violence at the elections. I think there's a great deal of concern. Obviously, we saw the attack on Saturday. Now, the Taliban or another militant group managed to strike in the heart of Kabul. That should be one of the safest areas of the country. And certainly in the lead up to the elections, the Taliban and other groups have called for those elections, the process, to be disrupted. So I think there will be concern that there will be more violence in the coming days, perhaps on polling day, which is on Thursday. That said, international forces as well as Afghan security forces have an elaborate security plan in place. About 2,000 security forces in total will be deployed across the country, and they will be protecting those polling stations. But as I said before, the Taliban have called for this election to be disrupted, so there may well be violence in the coming days.
Thank you, Martin, for joining us. Listeners, you were just listening to Martin Patience, BBC correspondent in Afghanistan. Also earlier, Jahid Mohseini, director of Tolo TV, a popular private TV channel in Afghanistan.
Hey, and we should remind you, you want to re-listen to that interview or anything on the show, get our podcast at our website, thetakeaway.org, or subscribe on iTunes. We've also been asking you to weigh in on the healthcare debate with the president and his opponents out there campaigning. Now it's your turn. What's convincing you? Confusing you, confounding you. Here's an email from ELR50. That must be a handle. I am confounded about the cause of opposition. We are the only industrialized country in the world who doesn't have a national health program. Whenever I hear someone in opposition, their arguments are either based on lies and spin or motivated by profit. Would you like to die because someone wouldn't be able to afford an extra day of vacation? Okay, what do you have to say to that? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And when it comes to both private and public options, here's your takeaway.
If the legislation does include those guarantees, we might be able to get 95% of what folks out there want.
Now, that's Dr. Michael Prumenko, a family physician in Grand Junction, Colorado.
And I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. This is The Takeaway.
Today, President Obama talks to America's fighting men and women. But will the Phoenix Town Hall generate more heat or light? That's what we're asking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 17th. John Hockenberry's away. I'm Amy Holmes, here with Catherine Lamfer filling in.
Hey, good morning, Amy. Also coming up this hour, we debunk some healthcare myths, check in on the elections in Afghanistan, and we celebrate the 50th birthday of the coolest jazz record ever, Miles Davis's classic Kind of Blue.
I certainly have a copy. But first, we're here with Kristen L. Rouse. She's a first lieutenant in the Army National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, as Senator, Barack Obama really took Walter Reed as one of his major legislative issues. The question I have for you, has he visited Walter Reed since being sworn in as Commander-in-Chief?
Since being sworn in, I'm not sure if he's visited. I know that he did write, I believe it was on the eve of his inauguration, where he went and visited wounded troops.
Is this something that veterans are really hoping for from him?
Well, I mean, to care for our current, wounded veterans coming back, obviously that's a big thing. But his initiative to, make sure Walter Reed got the resources that they needed, I can tell you, personally, it's worked. I was there just a few months ago to see a couple friends of mine who work there as Army medics, and it is an outstanding, state-of-the-art facility where they are taking great care of our veterans coming back.
Well, today, Kristen, he'll be talking to 13,000 of your colleagues at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Stay with us. We'll finish this conversation in just a moment, right after our top headlines.
While the president's talking to veterans, the talk in Washington stays on health care. The White House is backing off of its push for a public plan, saying it's open now to having nonprofit co-ops sell insurance as an alternative. In the Atlantic, the first hurricane of the Atlantic season, Hurricane Bill, is gaining strength. Meanwhile, in Florida, Claudette is downgraded to a tropical depression. The storm is dumping heavy rains over the region, but no major flooding or wind damage expected. Amy?
South of the border, Mexico is scrapping its entire entire force of customs inspectors and replacing them with 1,400 agents trained to fight drug smuggling. The shakeup is part of an effort to root out corruption. Another major economy is coming out of recession. Japan says its economy grew at a pace of 3.7% last quarter. Japan joins Germany, France, and Hong Kong in the recovery. We'll get a look at how the U.S. economy is doing today with fresh info on the housing market.
Now, here's some quick sports updates. Y.E. Yang, first Asian-born man to win a major golf title. South Korean was ranked 110th in the world, and then he knocked off Tiger Woods in the PGA Championship yesterday. The world's fastest man just got a lot faster. Usain Bolt shattered his own 100-meter world record at the World Championships in Berlin yesterday. Now, back to the economic news. Asian markets down today. The Dow opens this hour at 93.21. The S&P begins at 10.04, and the NASDAQ starts trading down about 1% at 19.85. With the president and his opponents out there campaigning, if you want to weigh in on the healthcare debate, do it now. What's convincing you, confusing you, confounding you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Amy Holmes. I'm in with Catherine Lamfer, and we're here in for John Hockenberry. So this afternoon, President Obama will be in Phoenix, Arizona to address 13,000 veterans. It should be a pretty big moment.
Wow. Is this going to be like another town hall meeting on health care?
Well, we'll see if these veterans are a little bit more, I don't know, well-mannered than some of the others in addressing their commander-in-chief. But first, let's hear what you had to say about health care.
Hi, this is Ron from Mattapoisett. Having been in the healthcare business for 30 years, I can tell you that the president's program will not work, primarily because if we all agree that the healthcare financing mechanism is broken today, to simply expand coverage to the population on essentially the same platform makes no sense.
A lot of thoughts there. Please give us a call. Let us know your take on the president's plan, possibly a public option, possibly not. Is it a trial balloon? Is it backpedaling? What do you think? Joining us is Washington Examiner reporter Julie Mason. She's back this morning to talk about what vets can expect to hear from the president this afternoon. We also have two veterans with us here in the studio this morning. We thank you so much for being here. Kristen Rouse, she's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan and a first lieutenant in the Army National Guard. We also have Bruce Smith, who is a naval petty officer during the Vietnam War. Welcome to you all. But first, Julie, I want to start with you. What can we expect to hear from the president as he addresses these 13,000 veterans in Phoenix?
Well, the president, you know, we've been talking about health care. He's been talking about health care. He's really going to shift gears. He's going to talk about America's obligation to returning warriors, and especially the war in Afghanistan, which isn't going well, which has lost a lot of public support. And they have a big election there in Afghanistan this week. So he's really going to shift focus and talk about those kinds of things. He also has a lot of making up to do with veterans who have not been happy with him at all.
Explain that for us.
Well, there were a couple of things. Early in his administration, the administration floated an idea to require veterans to pay for some of their service-related injuries through their own private insurers. And veterans were very unhappy about this. They felt the government should pay. And it never went anywhere, but it did leave a lot of bad feelings. And then more recently, I think you may recall, Homeland Security Secretary Jan Napolitano had to apologize for a report that her agency issued warning that some returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan were at risk for becoming domestic terrorists. And that sat in a very bad way with veterans. So Obama comes in, not a friendly group. Many of them voted for John McCain. So he's really got a lot of making up to do with this organization, the VFW.
Well, we have two veterans here who can share their views about this. Kristen, as a veteran, what do you hope to hear from President Obama this afternoon?
Well, I think given the moment in time right now with the Afghan elections coming up this week, I think now is the perfect time for President Obama to be articulating clearly what we're doing in Afghanistan and why it matters for our national security. You know, a veterans organization like the VFW, I think it's the largest organization of war veterans. And, you know, the military as a group of people, you know, it's our job to execute policy without question. The VFW is like our big brothers and big sisters who can speak back to the commander-in-chief and to Congress and hold them accountable for what they do with the military and what they do with returning veterans from all conflicts.
Hey, Julie made this sound like a tough crowd later today. How accurate is that, do you think?
It may be. You know, I really couldn't tell you. You know, I think that there's a lot of diversity amongst veterans, you know, and I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, that veterans are Republican or veterans are Democrat or veterans are veterans. And, you know, they represent, the citizens that they were drawn from, you know. And so there's going to be a lot of varying opinions. But I hope that his welcome at the VFW is a warm one because he is the commander-in-chief. And as such, agree or disagree, you know, he's entitled to that respect.
Well, Kristen, we have one of the big brothers that you were talking about here. Bruce, you're a veteran of the Vietnam War. And I understand health care is something that you really hope the president addresses. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, health care goes right alongside of the problem of homelessness. And the health care issues for veterans, we've all heard of the systemic problems at Walter Reed and other issues with my younger brothers and sisters coming home. And as anyone who's paid any attention over the last 40 years knows, this is not a new problem. This is something that was chronic during the Vietnam era and it still continues to be addressed. One of the first things that I think that he needs to do is to address the fact that there is a lot of, I want to say noise, but that was what I would say. There's a lot of people out there who are trying to convince veterans that the VA will change its policies, that there will be differences in the benefits and services as a result of any kind of health care change that does transpire. And the White House website has debunked that. But there are strong forces trying to convince veterans that that's a problem. And as far as the VA is concerned, I mean the VFW, I would say the majority of the VFW are my age or perhaps even older. I mean, frankly, I never wanted to be in part of it because it seemed like an old boys club that didn't really want younger members who had different ideas. And so a lot of these guys are either baby boomers like me or, you know, the proudest or the greatest generation, and their health problems are increasing. So if they're fearful that their VA coverage is being affected by any kind of health care change, it all ties it up into a scary package.
So, Kristen, as a member of the military, you're in what could be considered a socialized medicine program in that you get all of your medical care from the government. What are the strengths and weaknesses of that?
Well, in the National Guard, I do not receive health care through the National Guard unless I am actually on orders and I'm serving in uniform, which is, you know, on a part-time basis. But when I was on active duty, I did receive excellent health care. I was active duty at Fort Drum, New York, and, you know, during my time in service, I had excellent health care providers, and it was very easy. If I was sick, I went to the clinic, and they, you know, there's problems just like anywhere, but for the most part, I received very excellent care, and I never had to worry about it.
Bruce, would you agree with that, that there are lessons to be learned from how the military handles health care that can be applied to the general population?
Absolutely. From a very personal point of view, I mean, I'm aware of the chronic problems that I addressed a minute ago there, but on a personal basis, I have been cared for with nothing but the utmost respect. I almost got a little emotional, but I had a heart attack last year, and the VA took care of me exquisitely, and they continue to do so here in Manhattan. And so the things like, for example, medical records within a computer system, the VA has had that down for a long time. And we're still trying to figure out the hand scratches of doctors and the problems and even deaths that causes. So the VA has a lot to teach. Certainly, they're not perfect at all, but they have a lot to teach the regular civilian medical care.
We're talking to Kristen Rouse, first lieutenant in the Army National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and Bruce Smith, naval petty officer. But Bruce, one other question about this, that the military, a large part of their budget goes towards health care. It's very expensive to provide this level of health care. Do you think that really can be extended to every American citizen?
I don't think there's a question. If you put somebody in uniform and you put them in a place where they either have to kill or be killed, and they are serving our country, we all hear that phrase, then you have to deal with the problems that ensue. And if you aren't prepared to do that, then don't put them in harm's way.
So, Kristen, coming back to you, this afternoon with President Obama, what, say, top two things can he do to win more veteran support?
I think his most important job is to address the current policy in Afghanistan, because I think veterans, you know, of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, as well as past veterans, really need to know what what are we doing, and why are service members being asked to, you know, to put their lives at stake, and, you know, why are their families being asked to sacrifice what they are, you know, for this Afghanistan policy? And it's, you know, it's an important selling point for him to very clearly articulate that, also to, you know, say the name of PFC Bo Bergdahl, who is still being held prisoner by the Taliban, and he needs to say that name and let people know, let America know that soldier is not forgotten.
That sounds like the takeaway from the speech, in fact, that this name that so many of us don't know should be framed in the speech today.
I personally believe so. There's a lot of value statements that he needs to make about Afghanistan.
Interesting. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your service to our country, more importantly. You are listening to Kristen Rouse, First Lieutenant in the Army National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and Bruce Smith, Naval Petty Officer during the Vietnam War. Julie, really quickly at the very end, what did you make of what you just heard? Can President Obama make real inroads this afternoon?
Well, he can certainly try. A big problem Obama faces is there's just no money. You know, everyone agrees that veterans deserve the best care that this government can provide them, but the government is pretty much out of money.
Sobering thoughts. Thank you for joining us. That was Julie Mason, White House reporter for the Washington Examiner.
And I want to remind people that we are still looking for your thoughts on the health care debate. What's convincing you? Confusing you? Confounding you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you have a good argument why America should see health care reform the way you do, call us with that argument. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
That is All Blues, the fourth track on Miles Davis's classic jazz album, Kind of Blue, which turns 50 years old today, considered by many to be the greatest jazz album ever. And the odds are, Amy, if you own only one jazz album,
you own this one, that's for sure.
That's right. So what made this music stand out? Why is it cited as a before and after point for jazz? We're joined now by member station New York Public Radio's evening music host, Terrence McKnight. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
So talk about the history of this album. What was Miles going for here?
Miles was going for a variety of things. You know, this is coming out of the bebop era. And Miles had played with a lot of those cats, you know, Dizzy, and he was trying not to mimic or replicate what Dizzy had done so well, and so he was really trying to go into a different direction, and what he did with this record was explored modes as opposed to chords that were so important to bebop music. And not only was he exploring modes, but he was exploring, like, free time, and he was exploring just a variety of musicians who came from different backgrounds putting this music together, and he really created a different framework for the blues. This is a blues, but a different framework. It's in a waltz tempo. It's a 6-8-3-4.
So we're going to listen to a little bit of Freddie Freeloader. What should people be listening out for?
Very interesting story to Freddie Freeloader.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when they recorded Kind of Blue, it took two sessions. And yeah, so Miles shows up at the studio on 30th Street with his sextet, and he had two pianists. Now, he was using
Whoa,
this guy.
No.
Yeah, Wynton Kelly was his pianist who lived in Brooklyn. So Wynton shows up at the gig,
and
he noticed that Bill Evans is seated at the piano. So Wynton's like, hey, man, what's going on? I'm supposed to be doing this gig. So everybody's like, hey, man, just relax. You're on the gig. And so, you know, Miles knew the dynamic of his band. So this was a tune that they had probably been playing on the road a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what does Miles do? He starts the session, just to cool everybody out, he starts the session with this tune right here, and he uses Wynton Kelly at the piano for this tune. And who gets the first solo? Wynton Kelly.
Ah. Sounds like Miles Davis was a good manager on top of everything else. Hey, you know, you keep talking about how he was trying not to sound, you know, like the jazz that had gone before him. Let's give people a taste of Dizzy Gillespie, you know, his bebop.
The bebop era was all about speed, dexterity, virtuosity, playing fast, playing over chords. I mean, and they were really trying to, you know, really take the music out of this entertainment vein and make it a real connoisseur's art. And they didn't really necessarily care what the audience thought or like, lesser players could play this music. They were really trying to raise the status of the jazz musician with this music, so they made it very difficult to imitate.
Terrence, I read a quote that said, with Kind of Blue, that it didn't flaunt or flout its own genius. Was bebop kind of like, you know, look at me, listen to me, let me impress you, whereas Kind of Blue was a departure?
Absolutely. It was more subtle in that way. I mean, with modal jazz and what Miles did with Kind of Blue, they use, you know, just a few chords here and there. They use modes.
Ooh, let's listen. Let's listen. This is So What.
Yeah, so with this tune right here, So What, you know, he's using modes. And for most of these tunes, there are five tunes on this record. Miles went into the studio. He hadn't written anything down for most of these tunes. So he goes in just with a few sketches of these scales or these modes. And so the guys were able to improvise on this. And what the modes do, they give greater flexibility for the playing, for improvisation.
So are you saying that the So What, that was not a melody line that he had written before he went into the studio?
Here's the melody line. You hear the bass playing it. And they're responding. The band is saying, So What?
I read this album took, what, 9 hours to make, and that Miles Davis spent the rest of his life trying to equal or top those 9 hours.
Well, Miles Davis was all, you know, Catherine, the last time we were here, you and I talked about Michael Jackson and how he always kept reinventing himself and pushing the art form forward. Miles was doing the same thing. After he recorded Kind of Blue, he didn't look back at it. He was going on into new territory. So this for Miles, you know, it was important, but he kept moving and kept progressing as an artist.
And let's talk about who he influenced as he kept moving and kept progressing. Q-Tip, the rapper, even said that Kind of Blue is like the Bible. You just have to have one in your house. Who else was he influencing?
Well, John Coltrane is on this record, and at the same time that they were recording this, John Coltrane was working on his own record. And so John Coltrane is very well known for playing modal music. So a lot of what he did in the 60s was influenced by what he did with Miles. In fact, he used some of the same band members that Miles did later that year to make his record. So he influenced Ornette Coleman. He influenced, I mean, everybody who came after him. You know, you hear
and
a lot.
And it wasn't just jazz musicians.
It wasn't
right?
just jazz.
Pink Floyd,
artists. The Allman Brothers, that's right. Derek Trucks has recorded some of Miles' music. So,
all right, Terrence, give me my oral takeaway that, you know, what I should be thinking about as I listen to the last strains of this.
The beautiful thing is, Catherine, it allows you to think about whatever you want to think about because it just floats and it just lets you get through your day. And I think if there's one takeaway is that, you know, aside from everything else that's been said about Miles, all the tribulations he had in his life, what people will remember is this music.
Terrence McKnight, host of member station WNYC's Evening Music. We're listening to Miles. Amy.
Yes?
We got to get back to reality here.
Oh, do we have to?
Yes, we do.
Can't we just stay in that place?
We cannot. We cannot. Come on.
Oh.
The world is rushing by us. Just give me a few of today's top stories.
Got to hit some of those headlines.
Okay.
Tropical depression Claudette is dumping heavy rains across Florida as it heads inland to Alabama, losing strength along the way. Meanwhile, Hurricane Bill is in the Atlantic with winds of about 75 miles per hour. The first hurricane of the Atlantic season is expected to gain strength. Out west, President Obama is in Arizona today, addressing the annual convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. He's expected to repeat his promises to wind down the Iraq War and redouble efforts in Afghanistan.
Okay, now we're back
to reality for sure. In Asia, two earthquakes hit Japan's southernmost islands and the coast of Taiwan today. Both prompted tsunami warnings that were later lifted. There were no immediate reports of injury. Staying in Asia, family members of the American who was released from a Myanmar prison this weekend say that he is in poor health. John Yata is getting medical attention in Thailand. He was freed after U.S. Senator Jim Webb met with some of the nation's leaders there. That's some of today's top stories. Coming up, the healthcare debate has a lot of details and a lot of myths. We're going to do some debunking in the minutes ahead.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Amy Holmes. We're in for John Hockenberry, who's away. With all this talk about health care reform, maybe it's time to remind you, I don't know, what do you think, Amy, that there is no binding legislation?
It's floating around the House, the Senate, the Gang of Six, the progressives, I mean, all these committees.
So what do you think with all of that, that people might be timid about, speculating?
In Washington?
Yeah, well, I have two words for you, death panels. So how do you know what's really going on out there? To help us debunk some of the health care scares and stories going on out there, we have Trudy Lieberman, director of the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. She's joining us today from Columbia, Missouri. All right, Trudy, a lot of heat out there. Let's start right in and listen to this sound. It's an ad from a group called the 60 Plus Association.
The government, not doctors, will decide if older patients are worth the cost.
Trudy, just the music alone scares me. What's going on there?
Okay. Well, this is one of the very many ads that we have that are picking out little pieces of what might be in a bill. As you pointed out, there is no bill yet for anybody really to talk about. In this case, we have a reference to some language that was or is still in the House bill. It's hard to tell whether it's still in, which would provide some counseling for people. Once every 5 years, doctors would be able to get money from Medicare to help people understand what their end-of-life options were and are. And these include things like writing advance directives, living wills, all sorts of things that people should be doing now so that they can plan for how they want their last days to be. And this has been totally distorted by a number of groups that believe that this is going to lead to killing old people, euthanasia, and so forth. And that really is not true. And what's happened is that the word death panels has suddenly become part of this healthcare vocabulary. And there's nothing of the sort being contemplated here.
I want to have us listen to the rest of this ad from the 60 Plus Association.
Congress plans to pay for health care reform by cutting $500 billion from Medicare. For seniors, this will mean long waits for care, cuts to MRIs, CAT scans, and other vital tests.
Okay, you're sitting at home, you're on Medicare, you hear $500 billion?
Nobody's talking about any cuts to Medicare. Medicare does have some financial problems. The president has proposed trying to deal with some of these by cutting payments to hospitals and perhaps doctors as well. But what we really are seeing here is a scare tactic by an organization that has a vested interest in not having any kind of health care reform. What this also could mean is that it might be a way to try to preserve the Medicare Advantage plans for seniors. And this is something that the president and others have said that he would like to eliminate. And these, not eliminate, he wants to eliminate the overpayments for these plans. Right now, the government is paying these Medicare Advantage plans more, much more than it costs to provide the same benefits under the regular Medicare program.
Okay, Trudy, let's hear some more sound. This is from the American Medical Association and the Service Employees International Union. Okay.
It means you can't be denied coverage for a pre-existing condition or dropped if you get sick. It means putting health care decisions in the hands of you and your doctor.
Okay, how effective is this as a counter message?
It's sort of a half-truth in a way. The issue is that people will not be dropped for coverage if they have a pre-existing conditions in the individual market. This really doesn't apply to people who are in large group situations, which is where most of the people are who have health insurance. It means that people, if you have an individual policy, they have to take you, the insurance companies have to take you regardless of your health conditions and won't drop you. However, there is a caveat on this one. If that provision does take effect, there's likely to be something called age rating, which would still leave the insurance companies able to give you premiums or charge you premiums based on how old you are, so that age then becomes a proxy for health. So people can get insurance probably under this provision, but they will have to pay a lot of money for it.
Okay, Trudy, we have to wrap up here, but I want very quickly a succinct takeaway from you. What do people need to keep in mind once they hear the ominous tones of a healthcare reform commercial on either end of the spectrum?
I think they have to realize that that's exactly what it is. It's a commercial. It's designed to persuade, and that they probably should seek out other information that will be more neutral and give them the real scoop.
Okay, Trudy, thanks so much. That's Trudy Lieberman, Director of the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism.
It's such a hard topic, so complicated with all these moving parts and different committees, but it should be noted that last week the Senate Finance Committee did drop language that would have paid doctors to offer that end-of-life counseling.
So even though so many credible sources are saying, look, death panels, they're not going to happen, this thing that doesn't exist
did have political consequences.
Exactly.
It did.
Exactly.
So we also want to hear from you on the healthcare debate. What's convincing you, confusing you, upsetting you? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, moving to Afghanistan, earlier this morning we were talking to folks on the ground about what they're seeing in the run-up to the elections on Thursday. Well, we also wanted to talk to folks right here at home, Afghans who have made their lives in America, and are they following the Afghan elections. We're joined by Dr. Dawer Nadi. He was born in Afghanistan and lives in Long Island. He's a dentist and president of the Afghanistan Peace Association. Dr. Nadi, are Afghans living in the U.S. following the election closely?
Absolutely, yes. Afghans here are very excited about the elections in Afghanistan. And as far as I'm concerned, everybody's waiting for the results of this elections in Afghanistan. Because, as you know, Afghans have gone through 3 decades of continuous war, and they definitely support the chances of democracy and definitely this particular elections as an alternative for a way out of the war and misery that they are suffering for the past 3 decades.
So, Dr. Nadi, again, quickly, are you hearing from relatives fear about possible violence leading up to the elections on Thursday?
I do not think so. We hear about the possible violence by the opposition groups of this government, which are mostly, you know, the terrorists and the Taliban, and they have openly announced that they're going to disrupt the elections. But the majority of the people don't think that that's going to happen.
So, Catherine, it sounds like the takeaway is that Afghans are very invested in building democracy there, despite the threats of violence. Thanks so much for joining us. That was Dr. Dawer Nadi, dentist and president of the Afghanistan Peace Association, an umbrella organization of Afghan groups in the U.S. and abroad.
All right. Now, you know, on Mondays, we always talk about families every Monday morning. And today we're going to be looking at sports. You know, so many kids are going back to school as they flood back to those high school or lower school sports programs. Are we building champions or bullies? You're going to find out more coming up later on here in The Takeaway. Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Amy Holmes. So President Obama, he gets to hit the vineyard this Sunday with Michelle and the girls for what some are saying a very well-deserved vacation. With us to discuss it is Eric Looning, correspondent for WCAI, the Cape and Islands Public Radio, joining us from Martha's Vineyard. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Amy.
So let's jump right in. The Obamas have been to the vineyard before, but this time with Secret Service. Where are they staying on the island?
They are staying at Blue Heron Farm in Chilmark, which is a town here on the vineyard. The property is owned by William and Molly Vandevender, who actually are McCain supporters. reportedly.
Interesting.
Like it, yes.
That's
sure
a very Obama bipartisan thing to do.
I was going to say that, yes. I think it's an expression of his effort to be as bipartisan, even when he goes on vacation.
And let's face it, even if you're a McCain supporter, having POTUS as your house guest is a high honor. So what is Chilmark like? A lot of people thought that he might be in Oak Bluffs, which is a prominent African-American community, but he chose Chilmark instead.
Yeah, Chilmark, I think, in the end, makes the most sense. He was also looking at rental properties in Edgartown, which is near Oak Bluffs, but that's predominantly a sort of a yacht clubbing community. Oak Bluffs is the African American, has a long history of middle class and upper middle class residents who've been coming for over a century now. And of course, there's now African American celebrities. Spike Lee owns a house there and everything. But Chilmark, if the Vineyard, which is now being called Hollywood East, if the Vineyard's that, Chilmark is the capital of Hollywood East because a lot of newer money resides in Chilmark. A lot of celebrities, Bill Murray owns a home out there, Dan Aykroyd, James Taylor, of course, our music first family of the Taylors own property out there as well.
And but there's no bigger celebrity than Barack Obama.
Exactly. And there's the property itself has access to a private beach, so you know there won't be. It's close to the airport as well, probably just 5 minutes away from the regional airport. So, those sorts of things figure into the Secret Service planning as well.
So, Eric, this leads me to the question, will the locals get to interact with the Obama family? Will they be able to, you know, like ice cream sitting next to the president?
Right. Well, as we know, the Clintons came down many times during the 90s. And although the White House, of course, officially says there'll be no public appearances, it is a small island, and they will be enjoying, as every family comes on vacation, beaches, ice cream, dinners out. Of course, there'll be dinner parties. There are often a lot of people host presidential families for dinner parties. Ted Danson hosted the Clintons a lot. But, yeah, we're expected – Michelle is expected to come actually with the children a little earlier, maybe Thursday or Friday is sort of the rumor mill is saying. We have a big country fair that goes on every year. It's the 148th year of the agricultural fair, and that's something for the kids to do as well as Michelle.
Now, I read something funny that you guys have whipped up an Obama drink called an Obama-rita.
Yes, at our local it's the Mexican Fair restaurant, the Obama-rita, which has mandarin oranges as the base of this margarita. And
Catherine's making a face. Ooh, yes. Too sweet.
And then also, we have a local brewery, the Offshore Ale House, and they have started selling the Ale to the Chief.
Gotcha. Well, we will have to raise our glasses, maybe take a sip or two later. Eric Looning, thanks for joining us. Correspondent for WCAI, the Cape and Islands Public Radio.
Ale to the Chief.
Ale to the
Chief.
Come on. Didn't we already have a beer moment with President Obama?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Amy Holmes. Now, every Monday morning, we talk about your family here at The Takeaway. Coming up, sports and your kids. Are you raising a champion or maybe a bully? Meanwhile, we're also talking about health care. With the president and his opponents out there campaigning, it is your turn to weigh in on the health care debate. What's convincing you, confusing you, confounding you?
My name is Eric West. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. I am a Republican, but I hear all the rhetoric about how expensive the plan is. I don't hear any other solutions for how we're going to address the issue, except for it's expensive, it's no good. What about some good things about the health care plan that could benefit all?
All right. That's his take. What's your take? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let's look at some of the other stories we're monitoring this morning. Amy,
Well, Tropical Depression Claudette is moving across Florida into Alabama. It's expected to lose strength as it moves further inland. Meanwhile, Hurricane Bill is growing in the Atlantic. Now over to Arizona, where President Obama is scheduled to address a group of veterans. He's expected to thank them for their service while repeating his promise to wind down the Iraq War and redouble efforts in Afghanistan. Staying in the West, Nevada's dry season could be a lot drier this year. Budget cuts are forcing it to ground its cloud seeding program, which helps create rain clouds. Overseas, Iraq has indefinitely postponed its census that was scheduled to take place this fall. The government says the census could ignite ethnic and political tension. And it's a Monday morning, so you're probably planning to get a lot of things done today. Maybe go to the library, take out your garbage. And you can do these things, but not if you live in Chicago. As part of the city's budget this year, several reduced service days were added, which gives most government employees the day off without pay. That means much of the Windy City is COB closed for business. That's a look at the top stories.
Okay, wow. Hey, it's Monday, as we said, time for our weekly segment on the family. And this week, as so many kids are going back to school, new research is casting doubt on what benefits actually come to kids who play in school sports programs. We're especially looking at high school sports. Does that high school team make your kid a champion or a bully? Joining us is Kate Daly. She writes the Human Condition blog for Newsweek. We're also here with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And we have Mark Hyman, author of the book Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. Welcome to you all. Kate, I'd like to start with you. We are talking specifically about a new study from Tufts University. What does the study say about kids playing sports?
Well, this study looked at kids of all ages. They've been studying about 6,000 kids for a very long time, and they're looking at what happens to kids who just play sports and are solely focused on sports versus kids who do sports and other activities like 4-H and scouting. And what they found was kids who did sports and these youth development programs were really well-developed. They were growing into these nice adults. They were kind. They did a lot for their community. Whereas kids who just played sports and were solely focused on sports were more likely to be bullies and more likely to develop poorly throughout the years.
It's so confusing if you're a parent. You're supposed to be worried about child obesity and you're also supposed to be worrying about bullying. I mean, where does sports come into all of this?
Well, and I talked to the study author yesterday, Richard Lerner from Tufts, and he was saying he's definitely not anti-sports. His kids play sports. He thinks sports are great. The point is, you need to, if you're a coach or a parent, you need to make sure your kids are getting the right takeaway from sports so that it's about sportsmanship, it's about learning to be a good winner as well as being a good loser, as opposed to just dominating your opponent and win, win, win all the time.
Yes, win, win. Oh, sorry, you meant something else. All right, Ibrahim, you played sports as a kid.
Definitely.
So what are the positives? What are the negatives?
Well, my takeaway on this is that it helped me to understand what teamwork was about, and that was a true, honest thing that happened. And I think it was just a curiosity around sports and the enthusiasm to play with your peers. So I think a lot of what we were thinking about, about this study was that if your parent is pushing you and pushing you and pushing you, is it really about you and your curiosity to get out there? So that's my takeaway. It's like you have to be really interested in playing a sport just for the sake of the sport.
Yeah, I have a question about that. I mean, is there a self-selection problem here of the types of kids that might go into sports that sort of monomaniacally would be more liable to this kind of behavior? Because, human beings have been playing sports since the beginning of time. I mean, tell this to the Greek Olympians.
Right. Well, and they looked at kids versus, how very involved they were in sports, because there are some kids who play traveling league during the week and then little league on the weekend, and then they go to a private camp during the summer. And it really, all it mattered was, if you're going to play sports, you also need something that gives you context to make sense of the sports and teaches you larger life lessons. So whether that's scouting,
isn't that the purpose sports is supposed to serve, that it provides its own context? I mean, Ibrahim, you were talking about sportsmanship, etc.
Well, I think I fumbled the ball in a really huge football game when I was in high school. It was the end of the game. Our crowd went completely sad and depressed, and I looked over at my dad, and my dad shrugged his shoulders. He was like, it's okay. And that's what he said to me. He was like, it's okay, and it's not the end of the world. So I think a good father and a good parent will look to their kids and say, hey, it's not the end of the world. You're going to have other challenges and trials in your life, and sports is just a template for you to deal with that.
Mark, thanks for hanging in there. You wrote a book, Until It Hurts, about children playing sports to the brink of injury to win. So talk about the physical toll that you have seen kids taking in the name of sports.
I write quite a bit about how adults had structured sports for kids and how, in my view, that really is the issue. 75% of kids are dropping out of youth sports by age 13. So, I mean, that's hardly a success story. And the other aspect is this notion of specialization, which really was really not known in the 50s and 60s. But now, instead of changing sports with the seasons, it's very common for kids to be, let's say, playing soccer in the fall and maybe playing indoor soccer during the winter, maybe working with a private coach, going to a soccer summer camp. And the result is that, you know, kids are so much more skilled at their sports than they ever were a generation or two ago, but they're so much more vulnerable to injury because they're doing the same thing year-round. And, you know, we want to help our kids reach their potential as athletes, but in this intensive training, we're actually impeding that because kids often are not healthy enough to reach that stage.
Ibrahim?
I have a takeaway. Play sports like you eat your vegetables, seasonally.
Seasonally.
Exactly.
So you're like the locavore version of sports, green beans in the summer and some sort of root vegetable in the winter.
Right, that sounds very reasonable. But Mark, why is it then that parents have been pushing their kids to specialize as, in contrast to the 50s and 60s?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And what I think really is the issue is that we've come to regard sports for kids as a career path, as a stepping stone of sorts to, you know, more competitive travel teams, the high school varsity, college, and, you know, maybe the New York Yankees even. And that was never the case, or rarely the case, I think, in the 50s and 60s, when parents viewed sports as an activity that was, you know, contributed to a kid's overall health and well-being. Now, it's more of I think our ambitions have really changed the way we view sports for kids.
Yeah, Kate, I want to come back with you.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the study authors were very clear that sports shouldn't be an end unto itself. It should be a way to teach young kids lessons about life. And sometimes you win and sometimes you do lose. And I think that kids' sports today, losing has become really taboo. And it's all about winning all the time and getting the attention of the scouts. And you have these kids who are doing so many sports and so many activities. And this study found that they were more likely to be depressed because really they're just exhausted.
Well, wait a minute. I thought that the whole problem with sports these days is that everyone gets a trophy and there are no losers in T-ball. Usually those are the criticisms you hear about sports in schools.
And they may be a valid criticism. In the blog, we're doing a three-part series kind of looking at the different issues with kids in sports, and winning versus losing is one of them. The study author said, look, you kids need to learn how to lose. They need to learn this when it comes to jobs. They need to learn when it comes to relationships. And T-ball is a great way to learn that you lose, you brush yourself off, and you show up to the field next week.
But what about those kids who want to train for the Olympics, who do want to focus, you know, single-mindedly on reaching that goal?
I think one of the things you have to remember is that you're not everyone. There's only a small, small percentage of people that get to that upper level, that higher level of sports. So the athletes have to go into that and thinking that they might want to train for that, but it's not necessarily going to happen. Even the best athletes, you might end up on the practice field with a busted knee, and your whole career is done in an instant. So people have to be realistic about where they place sports as a priority in their lives.
And, you know, I think we want to put our kids in a position where if they're really driven, if this is what they really want, they have that opportunity and our support. But it can't come from us. It really has to come from them.
All right. That's Mark Hyman. Thanks so much for joining us, the author of Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. We were also talking to Newsweek's Kate Daly, author of the blog Human Condition, and our own sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He's teaching us how to eat our vegetables and play our sports.
We're also talking about health care all morning with you. It's your turn to weigh in. What's convincing you, confusing you, upsetting you? Here's a call from South Carolina.
I have a state job, and I was a huge Obama supporter. I actually went door to door for him, and I'm really starting to question him on this health care program. You know, I'm hearing things like they're going to cut employer-paid insurance. They're going to tax it. And that's one of the things that makes my job a good job. I don't get paid a lot. What I have are those benefits. If you start taxing those benefits and costing me more money, I'm going to have to find some other job.
All right. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Tell us what you think. I'm Catherine Lanford.
I'm Amy Holmes. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.